Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 406th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, the world universe.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And today we're finishing up our Tools for Practice series on opioids. And Tina will tell us about the merits or lack thereof of performing management of opioid use disorder in primary care.
Sounds exciting. Well, hello, my name is Tina Kronick. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine, and I've been spending a lot of time looking at the literature around opioid use disorder. So we did the tool for practice on treating patients with opioid use disorder in primary care, and this came out of when we began looking at making a guideline. We had a committee develop a set of questions, and one of the questions that came up was, where is the best place to actually manage patients with opioid use disorder? And I think this came from a place of some people thinking, yeah, I can do it, and other people thinking, no, I can't.
Yeah, and wouldn't I love to refer this somewhere?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, it may not be I can't, it's maybe I don't want to.
Well, that's just it. And if we could find evidence to support that, wouldn't that be great? And then we'd be done here.
One question, should we be doing it? No.
Yes.
Yeah. Done. It'd be the shortest guideline we've ever worked on, but unfortunately it was the exact opposite to you.
Yeah, right. And so we agreed to look at this question, but actually, to be honest, I didn't expect to find much in the literature. It seems a bit of an odd question, but and I will say that this question was originally led by one of our colleagues, Dr. Scott Garrison here, and Danielle Perry as well, members of the peer team. So they did the original search on all of this data. And what they found is they found that there were three randomized controlled trials of between 40 and about 220 patients that compared the opioid agonist therapy, either methadone or buprenorphine, in a primary care setting compared to that administered in a specialized opioid treatment program. So there you go. The people have done these trials. The mean follow-up was about 42 weeks. So I would say pretty impressive, actually. So they followed these guys for a long time. Most trials don't do that, right? So, again, like we've talked about, the big outcome that they look at is retention and treatment. That seems to be very common in this type of literature. Three randomized controlled trials, 287 patients. We meta-analyzed this data, and we found that there was a significant benefit in retention for those patients who were treated in primary care settings. So 86% of patients compared to 67% in the specialty care, which gives you a number needed to treat of about six. So that was surprising, strangely enough. Other outcomes, street opioid abstinence, three RCTs contributed to that. And measured by urine toxicology, so we would say that would be an objective outcome, or self-report, which is not always as reliable. Again, we meta-analyzed that data and found a significant benefit for those who were treated in primary care, 53%. Compared to 35% with the number needed to treat of six. The part that I liked the best actually was just the question they asked, what about satisfaction? As a patient going through this difficult time, how satisfied are you in these various settings? And there's just one RCT that asked that question, but 77% of patients in primary care said they were very satisfied compared to 38% in the specialty clinics. Patients often report higher satisfaction with information provided in primary care. So that was the second RCT that reported that.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to move on to the withdrawal symptoms.
I was going to say, I don't think the purpose of this is, you know, it's not to say, you know, because part of the bias here is, you know, most of you guys are involved with primary care, and it's not supposed to be a competition between the two.
Yes, it is.
Well, I know it is, but I'm trying to make you guys look reasonable, like you're reasonable people.
Oh, right. This is where you pretend we're not biased. Okay,
yes, exactly.
Go ahead.
So the only reason I'm saying is, I mean, these to do RCTs in this area are tricky at best, and The evidence, even though there's three RCTs, it's still relatively limited. And it's, like you said, you guys sort of have to meta-analyze this and all that sort of stuff. And all it is there's certainly a suggestion that there is, at least we know there's probably no difference between them, and maybe some advantages to primary care. And it may have not, we don't know what it has to do with it. It may not have anything to do with whether or not they're better at it. It's whether or not it's in primary care setting that's useful. So we don't know what the actual cause and effect is, but this is the best available evidence. Like we've talked about 405 or six podcasts in the past.
Yeah, I pick up what you're putting down there, James. And we had this conversation with our committee because many of them work in specialist care. Mm-hmm. And they said, there's probably, so they're randomized controlled trials, so they're not observational.
Oh, no, not
studies,
that's
something. But the point is not all patients are going to fit in a primary care setting.
Correct.
And actually, the patient on our committee, she said, you know what? My primary care doctor fired me. So
thank goodness,
specialty clinic, right?
That's a great patient to have on the committee, Tina, because it's telling you, it reminds us of one of the problems, right?
It does. And she said, you know what? My treatment was the best in a specialty clinic with people who didn't know me, but had the expertise and, the know-how to help me through this difficult time. So yeah, I agree. It's certainly not saying one's better than the other. And we certainly don't want to say primary care can handle it all, because like I said, some people were hoping the answer was just not going to be yes at all. But so crafting a recommendation around this is difficult, because primary care is, I think what it says, as you alluded to, is it can be done in primary care. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the important piece. And there'll be lots of patients we need help with, and that's why we have specialist colleagues, and that's what they're experts at. So there's the whole continuum there for sure.
Yeah.
Right, and it can be everything, right? It can be where it's managed completely in primary care with your same doctor. It can be your doctor getting advice. It can be a mentorship model where they're getting a lot of support. It can be a referral. The main thing is that patients are being taken care of. I mean, I was obviously completely joking in the idea of competition, but it is nice to know that this can be measured. And it doesn't come as a surprise to us, Tina, having done a lot of work in this field, giving talks on, why, kind of some support for primary care managed patients. And we've seen that in lots of other areas of the literature that primary care does at least as good a job when it's well equipped to do the task.
Right.
And so it doesn't come as a surprise, but it was a bit of a surprise to me that it was so good that it actually looks better in some cases, as you pointed out, with the number needed to treat of pretty close to 5 and 6, where it's about 20% better, and then for satisfaction about 40% better.
Yeah.
So very reassuring, I think.
Yeah, and so here's the other caveat that we debated back and forth a fair amount. So what does primary care mean? And so in the trials that we included, that definition of primary care often involved supportive teams, involved teams with other members who were there to support and to help. Often training was provided. One of the primary care settings was actually affiliated with a substance misuse clinic, right? So there's this additional sort of support available, and one enrolled physicians who had experience in treating this. So I think it's really important to recognize, it's an interesting discussion piece is, for one, these trials all had clinicians who were well supported, who had education, and who, felt reasonably confident in what they were doing. And that's, I think, important, and that would be our goal. What's interesting, which isn't included in this tool, another one of our colleagues, Adrienne Lindblad, when she was looking at pharmacotherapy, came across a couple of RCTs looking at pharmacotherapy compared to waitlist. So if I refer a patient to a treatment center, say to a methadone center, and they're waiting, versus they just get started on pharmacotherapy with no additional supports, no additional psychosocial, nothing, just pharmacotherapy compared to nothing, they did significantly better, and the numbers needed to treat were, again, 3 to 4. which was actually, to some of us, the most convincing data that, yeah, just starting the pharmacotherapy, wherever you are, regardless of your supports, seems to have good evidence of benefit for your patients.
So I would imagine it must, and it, a lot of this does come down to, like you said, the confidence of the person doing it, and how often you've done it, and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's primary care is not primary care, and specialist care is not specialist care. Really, you got to, there's a lot of nuances to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it says it can be done, and the wait list trials are interesting in that you don't need a ton of additional supports to start it. But you certainly do need to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And you heard it here on our podcast first. You need to know what you're doing.
I'm writing that down, actually.
Yeah.
There's your pearl right there.
Yeah. And one of the things that you need to know is the evidence, which is what we've been trying for the last three podcasts to let you guys know about it. Because, I'm probably going to get in trouble for this, but just because you are a specialist doesn't mean you're an expert in the evidence. And just because you're a primary care doctor doesn't mean you're not an expert in the evidence. It's not as simple as that. So let me ask you guys a question. So, you know, certainly a suggestion that in primary care, these people can be dealt with. In you guys' experience, when do you think of transferring them to more of a specialized treatment? Is there, how do you guys handle that?
Well, so it's definitely patient characteristics and are they doctor shopping? Are they using excessive? Are they trying to do things like, I've lost my script, can we get a refill on the script? Can I, you know, all of these things, including being problematic in the clinic itself, where I think some of us have had the experience of a patient of ours being abusive to the staff and all sorts of things because, you know, they're really struggling with their opioid use disorder or whatever use disorder it is for that patient. So some of that has to do, but some of it also has to do with, you know, there's barriers to the management of this where, for example, when I started practice in Edmonton 17 years ago or so, there was a lot of trouble getting patients in. So they waited a long time. Mm-hmm. So we actually ran a kind of bridging clinic for the longest time. And that was mainly run by one of my colleagues. But I helped out on it when he wasn't available. And so it changes, you know, if you're sitting there with your patient, you can't get them in. And sometimes it was very hard to even get a phone call returned. It changes how you manage them,
right.
Which is unfortunate when the wait lists are terrible. And back then, we didn't have a lot of other options. So if patients were really suffering and you were planning on a long-term kind of maintenance therapy, it was really methadone. That was really all we had. And if you weren't using methadone, you were really just bridging with another long-term opioid therapy. So I think things are changing, both what options are available to us. Certainly in Edmonton, it's much easier to get a referral in now and much easier to get support. Many places in the country, Ontario is really leading the way in a mentorship program, which helps us keep patients in primary care. So there's a lot of things happening right now that is different from just the patient in front of you. That's changing the environment to allow us to manage these complicated patients more easily in primary care.
And I can confidently say that this number is a true number. You guys are infinitely more experience with this than I do, because my experience with this is, well, actually I was going to say not quite zero, but because I worked at St. Paul's Hospital for a long time, but it may as well have been zero. So in this case, so we've got evidence that, you know, products like buprenorphine have an effect and so on. So what's the sort of approach when you identify a person who might have an opioid use disorder? What are the sort of educational things that have to go on around giving a prescription of buprenorphine to a patient?
Yeah, so that's a great question, James, because there's a whole that's one of the biggest learning things about the buprenorphine, naloxone, mm-hmm. naloxone is that patients have to be in withdrawal to initiate that because it's a partial agonist. So if they're not, they're going to be pretty symptomatic. So there's some great, so as part of the guideline, we're sort of modifying some resources, but there's some great resources available again on the BC Center for Substance Use and other areas that will give you information on how to initiate that drug. So you can do in-office initiations. And actually one thing that I think we'll see more and more of is take-home initiations where patients are given the medication and advised. You know, you can detox at home, and when you meet this number on the scale, go ahead and start taking that medication.
Right.
So, you know, when you wake up at 4 a.m. completely detoxed, you can take the medication as opposed to having to wait to come into my office.
Right.
So, some really neat information around how to do that, and actually. It may look overwhelming when you first look at it, but actually when you read through it, it's pretty straightforward. And then once they're stabilized, you know, hopefully a lot of those addiction type symptoms stabilize and they start to actually do much better.
Yeah. And I think in sometime, probably what you say in the next 2 to 3 months, you guys will get that guideline finished, and then we'll do a podcast and deal with somewhat the evidence, but also some of the practical nature of how to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anything else, Mike, you want to add to this issue?
No, that's good, James. I think we've covered a lot of good ground with how to identify it in the first one, pharmacotherapy choices, and the second one, which is probably your favorite.
Yes.
And then the third one, which was using or providing the intervention within primary care itself.
Yeah.
And I will say one little thing about that. The tool mentions that in 2 out of the 3 studies, the primary care was general internists. But it's important to remember that in the United States, general internists, like our friend Mark, perform the role of a family physician. And some of them haven't. They're office-based clinicians who provide primary care. And so I don't think that anyone should look at that and say, oh, well, then that doesn't really apply to me. No, those are, for all intents and purposes, family physicians.
Exactly, yeah.
They're primary care docs.
Yeah. No, mm-hmm. So hats off to you guys, for, and more Tina than Mike.
Always.
Yeah, for doing
that. I was going to say the audience may have noticed that Tina introduces herself as the director of peer. And I just wanted to note that I used to be the director of peer and didn't want to go, but Tina forced me out.
Yeah. The word coup comes to mind, but we will leave it at that.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, James, for pointing that out. It was hurtful, but my therapist says I'll get over it.
Yeah. Tina is, you know, when you meet her, she seems very nice, but she'll take you down in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But no, great work on this, guys. I mean, this is I hope people have an appreciation for how much work it is to do even a single tools for practice, let alone a guideline. And so, you know, you guys do just a ton of great work, and hopefully we do a reasonably good job of presenting it and putting it into the context of everything. So, you know, like I said, you guys are an impressive wealth of knowledge. And I'm not going to say anything other nicer than that, because I've already used up my entire year's worth of niceness.
Yeah.
So, January 14th.
So, yeah. So very quickly, please, our Best Science Medicine course is all ready for you to go register. And please come and join us in Vancouver. All of the usual suspects will be there, including the 3 people that are on this podcast, but even far more interesting and entertaining people as well. And that's May 3 and May 4 in Vancouver. And it's usually lovely in Vancouver at that time. We can't guarantee it, but usually. Mike, anything?
No, just advertising again for the webinar series through the College of Family Physicians of Canada. So February 12th for advanced care planning, and February 25th for a medical cannabinoid debate.
Yeah, so we'll put links to that. So thanks as always for listening.
All right, talk to you later. Thank you.